Everything from clothing to household items are getting more expensive each day. The world of fast fashion has complicated clothing production by outsourcing around the world to whoever can sew them the cheapest. And now you, the consumer, are paying the price with rising costs. American Giant is about keeping things simple and close to home. They aren't affected by tariffs because their products never leave the U.S. So when you buy from American Giant, you're taking a stand for hardworking people, local communities, and quality clothes. American Giant directly supports American manufacturers and ensures you aren't footing that tariff bill. Support American-made, tariff-free clothing with American Giant. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off when you use code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia, and dedicated to the proposition articulated by Walter Lippmann during World War II that a strong and balanced foreign policy is the shield of our democratic republic. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a Bulwark contributor and a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center. And I'm joined again on this Memorial Day by my colleague, Elliot Cohen, the Robert E. Osgood Professor of Strategy at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies and the Arleigh Burke Chair of Strategy at the Center for Security and International Studies. Elliot, welcome on this rainy Memorial Day. It's going to keep casting a bit of a damp pall over the parade later today.
Yeah, well, thank you. Speaking of parades and holidays, I thought we might begin by reflecting a little bit on Memorial Day. You know, it is it's the day that commemorates our war dead. It, unfortunately, for a while, it seemed to be morphing into the holiday that celebrates the beginning of summer, and so it's barbecues, and if they're parades, well, parades tend to be joyous affairs. I think in recent years, you've seen more people going out to cemeteries and decorating graves with flags and so on. And I do think it's appropriate to just pause and reflect. And I'd like to offer two thoughts. One is, if people haven't had the opportunity, they really should try to visit some of the war cemeteries in the United States. And of course, Arlington Cemetery is overwhelming, I think, 400,000 graves. But say, if you go to something like the cemetery at Antietam, which is actually still, I believe, operational. It's mainly, obviously, the graves of Union soldiers. It's a very, very moving place, or the various places throughout Europe. One in particular that I would mention is Chateau Thierry, which is actually the largest war cemetery in Europe, 14,000 graves, and it's all from World War I. And, you know, we think, because of the movies and so on, a lot about World War II, but, you know, something like 100,000 Americans lost their lives in the First World War. And all of these gravesites, which are taken care of by the American Battlefields Monuments Commission, they're just beautiful and haunting. And the last thing I'll say is, you know, obviously most people can't do that for one reason or another on a Memorial Day. But I know in my family, we've begun to commemorate Memorial Day by just reading one of the many very powerful war poems out there. And I'll just mention a stanza from, it's actually a British author, Lawrence Binyon, who wrote this during the First World War. And it's always used, I think, by friends of ours in Britain and Australia and other Commonwealth countries on Armistice Day, usually, but really at any appropriate ceremony. It's called For the Fallen by Lawrence Binyon. And the stanza goes like this. They shall grow not old as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years contemn. At the going down of the sun and in the morning, we will remember them.
Yeah, I mean, I love the idea of Antietam. I mean, we live in the Delaware, Maryland, Virginia area where there are a number of important Civil War battlefields and cemeteries. And of course, Memorial Day began, my memory serves correctly, in the late 1860s, to remember the fallen during our most bloody war, the one where we lost the most casualties of any, which was the Civil War. I know as well, I would be remiss if I didn't mention our colleague at the Bulwark, Will Selber, who's written a remarkable piece. It was posted a few days ago. I know I've asked that it be circulated to all of my colleagues on the Defense Policy Board, and I've sent it around to a lot of colleagues in the Department of Defense, which it's a very moving tribute to some of the folks that he lost while serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so important to remember those who've fallen in our most recent wars, as well as the ones further back in memory.
Yeah, and I mean, just to wrap this up, I think it's like when you go to a house of mourning and you're not quite sure what to say. And I think in situations like that, you know, you first you can use the words of others, like the essay you just mentioned, or you know, war poetry by poets like Alan Seeger and others. But it's also just about showing up. And I think showing up in those cemeteries, which really are hallowed ground, it's the right thing to do, and it's a statement. Well, Eric, let's talk a bit about politics. Once again, it's just you and me. There was a momentous, I think it's fair to say, election in Turkey, and of course, you were our ambassador to Turkey. You've continued to follow Turkish politics closely. I think it's fair to say you're not the greatest friend of Tayyip Erdogan. He seems to have won in an election that I suppose one can characterize as clean, although that has to be qualified in a number of ways, which you might wish to do, by a relatively narrow margin, is my impression. It's like about 52% of the vote. So could you just first reflect a bit on the election and what it means? And then I thought we could dive a little bit deeper into not just the future of Turkey, but the future perhaps of some of these other middle powers that are out there. So let her rip.
Yeah, I think it is fair to say that I'm not in President Erdogan's good graces. Actually, it is not just that I've kept up a steady drumbeat of criticism of the Erdogan regime and his policies since leaving government, but also when the WikiLeaks documents came out. The largest trove, of course, was from Baghdad, where Private First Class Chelsea Manning was situated. But the second largest trove came from Ankara because we were next door and we copied Baghdad on everything. And so because the ambassador's name goes on the bottom of every cable that comes out of the embassy, a lot of the telegrams that came out, including those speculating on reports we had from Turkish sources of Erdogan and the Erdogan's family's corruption, which has now become a major issue in Turkey. All of that came out, which led Erdogan to threaten to sue me in courts, either in Turkey or elsewhere, for defaming him. And since I take that very seriously, since he has sent God knows how many journalists to jail for defaming him, I unfortunately have had to postpone, you know, taking a blue cruise in Turkey with my wife indefinitely. So the election, you know, I put my money where my mouth was. I think wrote in the dispatch on Saturday morning that I anticipated Erdogan would win. And he won by about what I expected, about 52%. He's never really done better than that in an election because Turkey is a deeply, deeply divided society. And what I think the election tells you is that he has, for all my distaste for him personally, he is an extremely effective politician. And in particular, he's an extremely effective voice for a large proportion, you know, a bare majority, I would say, of Turks who feel that they have been in the past looked down on by the Istanbul and Ankara government and business elites in Turkey. It's, you know, if you look at where the vote came from, it, you know, his vote overwhelmingly came from the Anatolian heartland, the Turkish equivalent of flyover country. And he is, you know, a tremendous tribune of sort of Islamo-nationalist populism. I mean, he's managed to fuse both political Islamism with nationalism, with Turkish nationalism, and put a populist kind of glaze on it. So, you know, like other politicians we know, he constantly inveighing against globalist elites. But it's striking that because Turkey is so deeply divided, he has to rely essentially on a base mobilization strategy. He has not been able to expand his reach beyond that 52%, 51, 52%. He's never been higher than that, either in parliamentary or presidential elections.
So let me ask you a question. That's very, very useful overview. So first question is, in what sense was this a clean election? And in what sense was it not a clean election? And then the second kind of, I think, even more consequential question is, you know, to what extent is really Turkey en route to becoming a authoritarian state that will find it very difficult to come back to some sort of liberal democrat or democratic norms, I should say, you know, once he passes from the scene, because he is, after all, mortal.
A lot of Turks are very worried about that question, Elliot, today, and are, you know, trying to parse it out themselves. On the question of the, you know, health of the Turkish electoral process, I haven't seen actually the report from the election monitors. The OSCE and Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe had a delegation that monitored the first round of elections and came out with a report. And although there were some irregularities in that first round and some in this round as well, you know, some places where election monitors were tossed out of election, you know, polling places, and some ballot boxes that seemed to have been, you know, corrupted by pre-filled in ballots and things like that, nobody, certainly not the opposition, not the monitors, believes that it was on a scale that changed the result. And that's in keeping with a long tradition of, you know, essentially relatively free Turkish elections stretching back to 1950, when you had the first contested two-party election in Turkey. But whether it was fair or not is a wholly different subject. And there, the monitors 2 weeks ago pointed out that what has continued to be the case, the media environment is thoroughly tilted in Erdogan's favor. One of the state-run broadcasters, you know, gave him in the run-up to the election 32 hours of coverage, and Kılıçdaroğlu, his opponent, had like 32 minutes, which, to give you a, you know, sense of the magnitude of this, in the last day or two before the runoff, text messages from the opposition parties were blocked, so they couldn't get, you know, text messages out to voters. So, you know, there was no real fairness here. It's, you know, Erdogan has arrayed more and more power in his hands as time has gone on, and he's been in power since for 20 years. And so he's now been in power, you know, several years longer than Atatürk. He's the longest ruling leader in modern Turkish history. And because he has arrayed more and more power, it's become a very personalist regime. And so nothing really of consequence can be decided without his say so. And as to whether Turkey can return to kind of more normal democratic processes, Turkey's always been what Dean Acheson called an imperfect democracy. There's always been, you know, sort of influence from the top during elections, and not just under Erdogan. So never has it been as thorough as it has been under Erdogan. But, you know, he in his victory speech said, you know, I will be with you, the Turkish voters, we will be together until I'm in the grave. Now, technically, this should be his last term in office, but that doesn't sound like he's planning on going, you know, away anytime soon and leaving office in 5 years. Now, how exactly he will manage that, whether he will try and pass the baton to his son-in-law, the younger Al Bayrak, who is the entrepreneur behind the Bayraktar TD2 drone that's become so ubiquitous in Ukraine and now elsewhere. It's been used in Libya and in the Caucasus. Whether he will end up, you know, being the successor, whether Erdogan will try and, you know, stay on and pass, you know, amend the constitution, he could certainly try and do that. But I think a lot of Turks believe that this was their last best chance to stop him from essentially becoming a president for life. And we'll have to see whether, you know, as time goes on, he's able to, you know, maintain his position. He is going to be facing a major, major economic crisis in the days ahead. And that will be a real test for him.
Well, you know, I was going to say that one of the things that's so striking about this is that, you know, you have an economy that's in terrible shape because of his policies. I mean, it's not an accident. And then you had that massive earthquake, the response to which they botched. And still he didn't pay the penalty. Now to step back a bit, I mean, one thought that occurs to me is if you look at Erdogan, you look at Viktor Orban, I think there are other figures in the world. Israel is a democracy, but there's a little bit of this in BB2. These populist leaders who've been around for a long time, who invoke religion, who don't, you know, overtly take down democratic institutions, but subvert them and corrupt them, who are personally very corrupt, you know, where there's a lot of money that's sluicing into, you know, industry and so on. You know, you could say that Putin is the furthest example of this, you know, because there's, again, the same thing. There's criminality. There's the forms of democracy. There's deep corruption. There's the use of religion and of a kind of a state religion. I think as we step back, we have to think about, and let's face it, there are echoes of that even in the United States. I mean, I think David French, who I actually would be very good to get on, you know, has written eloquently about Christian nationalism, which he doesn't view as particularly Christian. And I'm not a Christian, so I'm not in a position to judge, but it seems to me that he's right. So why do we think this is all happening now? And what do we think the trajectory of that is? Because it seems to me it's one of the larger unstated issues of our time. And of course, I'll just say, go a little bit beyond that and say, I think one of our faults as a country looking at the world is we tend to compartmentalize, say, okay, we got a Hungary problem in, you know, getting the Swedes in. We have a Turkey problem also in getting the Swedes in, but sort of other things we don't like. But we don't put it all together. And here, this does feel to me like some sort of common development. And I particularly felt that when you referred to Anatolia as flyover country.
So political scientists refer to these kinds of regimes as competitive authoritarian regimes or electoral authoritarian, you know, regimes that they, and I suppose, you know, it's a tribute to the notion that our friend Frank Fukuyama articulated a while back when and we discussed with him on the show, you know, there was this moment of triumph of democracy at the end of the Cold War. And it's interesting that these regimes all seem to feel that they've got to at least pay kind of ritual obeisance to the forms of democracy, if not democracy itself. And you end up with not rule of law, but because of the corruption and everything else that you were discussing, you get rule by law with, you know, opponents being jailed and, you know, et cetera. And there are, you're right, there are echoes here. While you were traveling, we had Paul Miller on talking about his book about the rise of Christian nationalism, very worrisome. And Paul comes at it like David French, as an evangelical Christian himself, who is troubled by, you know, what he sees going on in the name of religion here and politics, you know, in the United States. Look, I'm not sure I have a great answer, you know, for why this is happening. It is a global phenomenon. I do think it is happening globally. I think it's in part a reflection of a variety of trends that we see as a result of globalization at the, you know, sort of tail end of in the post-Cold War era, at the end of the 90s, the lowering of trade barriers and other barriers. So a lot of this is caused by migration. And the cultural backlash that migration has stimulated. You certainly see that in Viktor Orban's Hungary. It was a factor.
You see it in Turkey.
Big factor in Turkey, I mean, because of the Syrian refugee population. I mean, the irony of that, of course, is the policy in Syria that Erdogan followed was very personally associated with him. Not a very popular policy, but he is responsible ultimately for some of what's happened in Syria. And now, you know, is talking about expelling the nearly 4 million, you know, refugees on Turkish territory. I think it's also, you know, the unequal distribution of gains from globalization. This is where populism comes in. You know, there's no question that globally, elites in various countries have been the major beneficiaries of the, you know, run-up of incomes as a result of globalization. Not everybody's been a part of it. And so there's an economic populist dimension to this as well. And then there's another dimension, which I don't think people talk about enough, which is a kind of global reaction around the world to the increasing number of women entering the workforce. And I think that, you know, that in many different cultures, in a lot of different ways, has given rise to a backlash among males who feel threatened by having, you know, a woman to whom they might have to be, you know, answerable now in the workplace, and perhaps a spouse who's not at home all the time taking care of all their needs because they're in the workplace too. So I think all of these factors, I think, have contributed to this phenomenon. But you're quite right. It's a global phenomenon and a troubling one.
Yeah, I think, you know, it seems to me it has, what makes it so difficult is it has multiple roots. And you can tell me if it's inappropriate for me to apply these to Turkey as well. But one is, you know, in the United States, we sometimes talk about the great sort, where, you know, people live with people who are kind of like them. And I was very struck when you look at that electoral map that you mentioned at the beginning. The Erdogan vote is, as you say, in this kind of the semi-rural heartland. I mean, there are cities there too, like Konya, but, you know, the more westernized elites in Istanbul, it just, you know, that's not, it's a different place. So that's one thing. I do wonder if there are two other things at work, though, too. One is, and this is a fault of the elites, which you and I belong to, everywhere, not having fully understood the imperative of not just tolerating, but in a certain measure supporting and even celebrating some traditional virtues and values, whether it's patriotism or, you know, traditional forms of religious belief and observance. And I think particularly in the United States, I have to say I do interpret some of the Trump movement to a kind of backlash against, you know, bi-coastal elite views, which are really just alien to people. But I think the other thing is the transformation of the nature of work. And one part of it is, as you say, the entrance of women into the workforce. But I think there's just also been a change. You know, when my grandparents came, and I dare say the same is true for yours, when they came to this country, you know, with a strong back and a willing heart, you could forge a life for yourself, and actually a pretty good life, and your kids could get ahead. And they could have a better life than you could. And you could, you know, because of public education, stuff like that, you could get them educated and, you know, they would have a chance. And I think that's just not the case. And there's nothing to be, at one level, there's not a whole lot you can do about that. I mean, the nature of modern manufacturing has turned into something like modern agriculture, more productive than ever. It just, you don't need nearly as many human beings. You can do it all with machines, or almost all with machines. But it does present a social set of challenges. And I have to say, you know, the worst part of this is I don't think there are any politicians out there who really particularly wrestle with this, you know, in a serious way. I'd like to ask just one more Turkey, though, question before we move on to some other things. So, you know, I think I have heard you say that Turkey is an ally in name only, which is a pretty harsh statement. I think in general, the expectation seems to be that in return for a bunch of F-16s, they'll let the Swedes into NATO. Is that really the case, though, that Turkey is now an ally in name only? And if that's the case, how should we think about that? What are the larger implications?
Before I answer that, let me just say your earlier comments are absolutely right about the big sort and how it affects Turkey. When I was ambassador, I never got up to Istanbul as much as people in the business and media community who were, you know, basically up in Istanbul, not in the, you know, capital of the country. I would go up there, though, and people would say, what's happening in Turkey, Mr. Ambassador? Because I was like, you know, it's very striking. You go across the, you know, the bridges over the Bosphorus and, it says, Asia on one side and it's Europe on the other. And I think that, it's a telling indicator of the kind of thing you're talking about. So I think that's very accurate. Look, when I say that Turkey is an ally in name only, they are obviously, a signatory to the NATO treaty. But NATO is, an alliance of nations, but it's also very explicitly an alliance of values. Now, it hasn't always lived up to that. Portugal and Greece were, military dictatorships or fascist dictatorship in the case of Portugal for, periods of time, at the outset of the alliance. But, particularly since the end of the Cold War, it's been very much an alliance of values. And as new members have come in, it's been all about values. It's one of the reasons why Hungary is such a problem and an outlier now, as it espouses illiberal, values quite explicitly. And Erdogan, I think, because it's a very personalist regime, as I said, is inclined, I believe, to define the national interest as what's in his personal political interest. I mean, there's no Turkish interest being served by the blockade of Finland, which has now been lifted, or blockading Sweden from, entering NATO. I mean, certainly there have been an effort to work out issues. They could have, been worked out before. Look, Erdogan told the Finns and the Swedes before they applied that he had no objection. Then suddenly after they applied, suddenly he had an objection. So what I think that means is Turkey's a very important country. It will remain an important country because of its location. It's a Black Sea nation. It's an Eastern Mediterranean nation. It sits right cheek by jowl with other countries who have had major finds of gas in the undersea in the Eastern Med. So Turkey's going to remain very important. The United States, I believe, is going to have to play a long game in the hope, as you say, that the actuarial table will come to our assistance at some point and Erdogan will leave the scene. It's not 100% clear to me that anybody else would be as talented as he has been in exploiting the forces that you and I have been discussing. And I think what we have to do is, unfortunately, adopt a very transactional approach to, Erdogan, because everything's going to have to be, you want this, what am I going to get for us doing it? You want F-16s? I mean, I think he's going to want a meeting with Biden to, be able to show the Turkish population that he's a, world leader who gets to meet with Biden. Biden clearly has a big distaste for Erdogan, doesn't want to meet with him. He's going to probably have to suck it up and do it at Vilnius at the summit. But I think the answer ought to be, once you've lifted your blockade on Sweden, then we can talk about a bilateral. They want, they're going to want some progress on F-16s. I think that makes sense because we kicked them out of the F-35 program because they bought the S-400 Russian air defense missile. But I would much prefer Turkey to be flying fourth generation U.S. fighters rather than buying Chinese or Russian fighters, which will be the alternative if we don't provide them. So we're not giving them something that will compromise our qualitative military advantages because of the F-35's unique characteristics. So I think F-16s make sense, although it's distasteful to have to do this kinds of transactional things with countries that are nominally allies.
Yeah. You know, I think you and I have talked a bit about the need for what I'm going to refer to as the higher transactionalism in American foreign policy. Let me actually segue this discussion a little bit, if it's okay with you. So Henry Kissinger is turning 100 years old.
He has turned 100 years old.
He has turned 100 years old. You and I have read his academic works, A World Restored, Bismarck, the White Revolutionary, which is actually a really interesting essay, a number of fascinating essays. These are from the 50s and 60s on American foreign policy, which really deserve a lot of attention. His a truly extraordinary memoir, White House Years, which I think is just, you can't be absolutely sure of the veracity of every single last word, but it is you never can in any memoir, but it's a magnificent, magnificent, fascinating memoir. And on top of that, you and I both know him moderately well. We've worked with him in the Defense Policy Board and other settings. And I think it's fair to say we both have a cordial to warm relationship with him. Now, the thing, maybe to get the ball rolling, I mean, there do seem to be two different, very different ways in which Kissinger gets treated, either as this extraordinary sage, kept delivering pronouncements from a foreign policy Mount Olympus, or as a war criminal, duplicitous, conniving, underhanded, you pick your adjective. And I think both of us would reject both of those views, since we don't always agree with him. But I think we have a high regard for him. I'll maybe get the ball rolling on this. I'll say that one of the things I think people miss about Kissinger is, two things maybe that they miss about him. One is a deep-seated patriotism, the kind of patriotism that only a refugee immigrant has, and which is really a critical part of his persona that I think gets underplayed. And the second thing is his sensitivity, personal sensitivity. And I'm not dishing on any conversations I've had with him, but if you go look at White House Years, there's a very poignant description of a meeting with a bunch of his fellow professors at Harvard. I think this is during the Cambodia bombing. Some of these have been the guys who got us into Vietnam, for crying out loud. And he describes a meeting in which there are just a lot of kind of caustic remarks, lack of, and it's clear that this left him deeply wounded, and it shaped his decision not to return to Harvard, which he could have.
And to give his papers to Yale.
And to give his papers to Yale, indeed, which is about as big an insult to Harvard as you can imagine. And the thing that strikes me is, having talked to him about the academic world, I mean, he's occasionally made a few wry comments about my staying in it. It's clear that that episode, it's not that it rankles, it left scars, and those scars are not fully healed even today.
Yeah. God, it's such a complicated topic, and I have such complicated feelings. But first, Henry has been nothing but gracious and extremely nice to me personally. And I agree with you. I mean, I don't know that I've ever met anybody. Well, I've met a number of people in Washington who are concerned about their reputation. I'm not sure I've met anybody quite as concerned about it as he is. And you're right. I think there are these sort of dueling kind of images of Henry, and some people who have worked for him who, recently have come out, excoriating him, which seems to me to be very bad form, as he is essentially beginning to fade away. I have a lot more sympathy than I once did for the difficulties he faced trying to extricate the United States from Vietnam. And I think I agree with you that I find the criticisms of people like McGeorge Bundy, the late McGeorge Bundy, and others who got us into Vietnam, and then turned on Henry to be somewhat disreputable. On the other hand, he had the misfortune of serving, one of the most paranoid presidents we've had. I would have said most malicious, but he's now been surpassed in that category.
Yeah, no, he lost that contest a while back.
But look, I think it must have been really hard to, you know, work inside the Nixon White House, which suffered from all sorts of dysfunctions having to do with Nixon's personality.
And the people around him, too. You know, I think it's a White House is never just the president. And, you know, the characters that he brought in were themselves difficult, some of them duplicitous, scheming, backstabbing.
Yeah.
And Kissinger was thrown into the mix of it. And I also, just to reinforce your point, as you think about the difficulty of extricating ourselves from that war, and, you know, people now view him talking about a decent interval as a sort of cynical. Well, actually, there was something to it. I mean, he was concerned about America's reputation. He understood reputation is part of the currency of power. They're dealing with a horrific domestic circumstance. I mean, nothing like what, say, our boss, George W. Bush, faced during the Iraq War because of a draft and a much higher casualty. So I'm with you. By the way, truth in advertising, I should also say he has also been nothing but gracious to me as well, to include blurbing my books. So I'm grateful to him for that.
Yeah. I mean, I do think, you know, there are lots of things about which one can be, you know, critical about the Nixon policies. I mean, I am actually a huge admirer of Secretary of Defense Melvin Laird, the late Melvin Laird.
Yeah.
Who I think was both one of the greatest secretaries of defense that we've had, but also in every way a match for Henry, which I think Henry, were he joining us today, would agree with.
Yeah. He says as much in his memoirs.
Yeah, that
every time he thought he had closed a door, Laird came back in through another one.
And Laird was bound and determined to get the United States out of Vietnam. And pressing constantly to move forward with the Americanization of the war and, the Vietnamization of the war, and to pull the de-Americanization of the war, which was, I think, ultimately correct judgment on his part. One can, you know, criticize Henry and Nixon for some of the duplicity of the negotiations they were involved in, although, you know, it's really hard to be too critical, given what we now know about the North Vietnamese, which is that they had no interest in negotiating at all, zero. And that's been revealed from the North Vietnamese records and the excellent work that a number of historians have done on that. I do think he and Nixon gave away too much to Mao and Zhou Enlai in 1972. And I do think some of our problems with Taiwan today are a result of, you know, not quite as much attention to detail in the Shanghai final communique from that summit as there should have been, in my humble estimation. I mean, I rely heavily for that judgment on Margaret McMillan's, you know, excellent book on the Nixon-Mao summit. But overall, I agree with you. I think Henry was motivated mostly by a desire to preserve America's reputation and, you know, to get us out of a terrible war that was tearing the country apart. I think he also, by the way, I would be critical, and we talked about this a little bit in terms of detente with the Russians, which I think he grossly oversold to the American public, which then created all sorts of problems later, because, the strategy that he and Nixon had of entangling Russia, the Soviet Union, in a web of interlocking trade and other agreements really did nothing to constrain Soviet behavior around the world. In fact, it convinced the Soviets, I think, that they were in the mid to late 70s kind of playing a winning hand. But again, you know, these are details, as Henry would say.
Yeah, I think there's a larger issue which really goes to the heart of his conception of foreign policy. And I think in a certain way, I haven't actually quite said it to him this bluntly, but I think I would say is you know, where I think where one of the ways where I would part company with him is he's actually not enough of a realist. I mean, he's there is a somewhat romantic idea of great power politics as, you know, deals that are done by eminent statesmen at the top. And although there's a lot of attention to sort of the deep historical currents underneath, which, you know, I think he's absolutely right to focus on, and which he can sometimes characterize just brilliantly. And again, I really would refer people to the White House years, because I just think it's like a treatise in statesmanship. But still, it's a somewhat romantic notion. So, you know, you don't have a sense he's actually looking there to really do the Russians in or do the Chinese in, or just say, yeah, they're a gang of cutthroats and murderers. They'll come back at us once they've taken advantage of whatever it is we have to give them. And I think, you know, that helps account for, you know, his continued engagement with, let's face it, with Putin and his whole series of Chinese leaders, you know, not out of corrupt motives, I don't think, but I think because he thinks that, you know, ultimately this is about, you know, serious people, a favorite phrase of his, having serious discussions, coming to understandings, you know, and moving along. And I think that's, unfortunately for the world we live in, that may not be hard-edged enough.
So a couple of thoughts on that, Elliot. One is, I think we tend to forget how young Henry was when he became National Security Advisor. He was 45 in 1968, and he came to it without any previous job in government. Now, he had been a consultant to the NSC, to Bundy, in the Kennedy administration for a number of years. And of course, he was very close to Nelson Rockefeller and was involved in a number of commissions for the, you know, public good that Rockefeller had sponsored in the late 1950s as part of his, it was partly do-gooderism, but partly also anticipating a potential, you know, Rockefeller presidency at some point in the future, which in the late 1950s seemed very plausible. And so, I mean, I think it's actually, you know, his achievements, you know, are in some sense truly remarkable given the lack of experience that he had when he came in at 45 and all the other factors that we have discussed.
There's several remarkable aspects of it. One is, if you read the memo that he wrote to Nixon on the organization of the NSC staff, I remember when I first read it, and I think actually I first read it carefully after I'd been in government, I said to myself, how did somebody who had never actually served in government and had a sense of, you know, what things are like, how did he come up with this brilliant piece of writing? The other thing which I give him enormous credit for, he had a great eye for talent. And he brought in people who would disagree with him. Now, he wasn't easy to work for, apparently. I wouldn't know. I wasn't there.
I've heard that on good authority from many people who did work for him.
But, you know, he had people who did not share his views, some of whom broke with him very dramatically, some quite bitterly.
Right.
But including Daniel Ellsberg, I believe, and Morton Halperin.
Tony Lake.
But still, you know, there's something impressive about that. You know, it's the old saying goes, you know, first-rate, our old mentor, Al Bernstein, used to say, first-rate people hire first-rate people, second-rate people hire third-rate people.
Right. No, there's no question about that. Although I think he had seen a lot of the, in terms of the memo about organization of the national security process under President Nixon, he had seen, I think, a lot of negative example under the Kennedy administration of lack of process, right? Because the Kennedy brothers basically undid the staff process that Eisenhower had created, and they weren't alone. A lot of critics were saying it was, you know, too reactive, too stodgy, you know, et cetera. But I guess my biggest problem with Henry's kind of realism is, you know, I think it takes its root in his, you know, very brilliant study of the Congress of Vienna in, you know, 1814-15. And the world is no longer made up of multinational, you know, empires with monarchs who were related to, you know, one another in many ways, and spoke a common language because everybody spoke French. You know, I mean, it's a brilliant book, and I think, you know, people have said that they think Metternich is the hero. When I read that book, I think Castlereagh is.
Yeah, Castlereagh
is really the hero.
By the way, it was his PhD dissertation.
I know.
Which is usually, I really don't want people reading my PhD dissertation.
Mine is now used as a booster seat for my grandchild. So I heartily concur. But, the world, I mean, I think there's a real underestimation of two things: ideology and how it affects perceptions of national interest, and also the nature of regimes, right? So, you know, Putin is not an ordinary statesman. Just as, you know, when A.J.P. Taylor said Hitler was just an ordinary German statesman, he was making a huge category error.
Yeah.
Because Hitler was not an ordinary German statesman. He was motivated by an ideology. And in Putin's case, there's both an ideological and a criminal enterprise element of this. I mean, Russia is run like a criminal enterprise.
Right.
And I don't think you can negotiate internationally with those kinds of regimes in the same way that Castlereagh, Metternich, you know, Alexander, Tsar Alexander, and Talleyrand negotiated, you know, about the future of Europe, because they were just not the same common conceptions of legitimacy and of how territorial disputes could be resolved through the principle of compensation, you know, which doesn't really apply anymore, to what we're dealing with in the 21st century.
So I'll maybe to wrap things up a bit, I do want to mention two of his qualities, which I think, whether one agrees or disagrees, and I hope it's evident from this conversation that you and I do have a great deal of respect for him, and a certain degree of affection as well, I suppose. One is, you have to be impressed by his endless curiosity and, you know, his continuing to write books, you know, at well beyond the age where I intend to be putting pen to paper. And, you know, or look at this latest fascination with the implications of AI. Now, I'll confess I haven't read the book that he wrote with Eric Schmidt. I don't know whether it's any good. I don't know how to think about AI. Maybe we can get somebody on the show who can tell me how to think about AI. But you have to admire somebody who in his late 90s plunges in like that. The other thing is, I will confess, I am charmed by his sense of humor. And it's a... Now, so... I don't know, it's used somewhat self-consciously, I think, particularly self-deprecating humor. It usually is by prominent people when they, you know, it's a way of disarming people. But it's genuine. It's always been there. And, you know, at the end of the day, somebody who has that sort of sense of humor, it, whatever the size of their ego, whatever you agree or disagree with, it does indicate some sort of sense of proportion about how one views oneself. I give him a lot of credit for that, because let's face it, you and I both know plenty of humorless people in Washington.
Yes, and with egos that require service with much fewer accomplishments under their belt to justify it. I agree with that. I mean, I do think it's interesting that he seems to have revised some of his views about Putin and about the conflict in Ukraine. And I think that's to his credit.
Yeah. I think more than he has about China.
Yeah. And I think, you know, therein lies, I think, a problem. You made the comment that you think his views on Putin and China are not for corrupt motives. And I don't necessarily disagree with that. But on the other hand, he has gotten very wealthy as a result of his work at Kissinger Associates. I think it has made it harder to disentangle that part of, you know, his views on these subjects. And, I think ultimately that is, you know, a question historians I suppose Niels Ferguson, who is, you know, working on the kind of authorized biography and has published one volume, will have to wrestle with, you know, as they, you know, complete the story of his incredibly long and, you know, fascinating life.
Yeah. Realists, of course, in theory, should think of states somewhat detached from individual personalities. I think once you've been in those positions, though, there is an undeniable rush about being invited, as he used to be, on an annual basis to fly to Moscow in a private jet to have dinner with Vladimir Putin, or to, you know, whenever you want to visit China, you can be sure that you're going to meet with people at the absolute top. I think that's you wouldn't be human if that didn't go to your head somewhat. But I, you know, I take that point. Well, he's an endlessly fascinating, complicated human being.
You know, I will. There is a danger in that kind of privileged communication with foreign
leaders. Oh yes, oh yes.
And you know, I one example. You know, I got a call from Henry when I was Undersecretary of Defense to report on his meeting with President Putin about a month or so after Secretary Gates and I had gone over there at President Bush's direction to talk to Putin about the decision President Bush made to put a missile defense system into Eastern Europe with a mid-course radar in the Czech Republic and interceptors in Poland, which was intended to deal with the looming and ongoing threat of Iranian ballistic missiles. And in it, in the conversation I had, Henry kind of recounted Putin being very angry and agitated at the meeting, in which he accused Secretary Gates of being rude and brusque and, you know, having dissed him. And it was 180 degrees, you know, out from the actual meeting, in which Gates had been, you know, incredibly emollient to Putin. In fact, Putin had had to call the meeting short because Yeltsin had passed, and he, you know, the meeting was cut short by 45 minutes. If there was anybody who was brusque or curt in that meeting, it was Putin. And Gates had actually gone to the trouble of getting the memos we were working on with how we could cooperate with the Russians on missile defense against a common threat from Iran translated into Russian so that, you know, Putin would have it right in Russian rather than a English non-paper in front of him. Maybe it was, but this is the kind of thing that Putin and others are able to do because they know Henry will have influence and a hearing and all that. So it's, there's a lot of danger, I think, in those kinds of privileged channels of communications.
Yeah, I agree. But still, we wish him a belated happy birthday.
Yep.
And, you know, at this point, there's an old Yiddish expression, bis 120, you know, maybe you live to 120 years, that may be a little bit of a challenge, but getting to 100 is a pretty good deal.
I hope I can emulate him. Well, I think that wraps it up for this episode of Shield of the Republic. Elliot, thank you for joining. We'll look forward to having you report in from not Europe, but Vermont on our next occasion. And if you enjoyed this episode of Shield of the Republic, please drop us a line at shieldoftherepublic@gmail.com or leave a review for us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from.